Laura, thank you very much. A great pleasure to be here after many, many years of coming to this great institution. Let me just begin by saying that my remarks are completely in my personal capacity. They don't represent any of the views of my clients or my firm, and I may not even agree with them. In that sense, also, my remarks are from the point of view of a practitioner who deals with live issues that are put before decision makers and will reflect, therefore, a rather basic approach to some of these issues that that I need to discuss. Having said that, I'm aided by a very interesting recent development this week. Venezuela has given formal notice to the World Bank that it is terminating its membership in the International Center for Settlement of Investment Disputes. I presume that institution is known to all of you, ICSID being the investor state arbitration body of the World Bank. It's not the first state to do so. It was preceded by Bolivia and by Ecuador. But it's certainly a symptom, a political symptom, if you like, of a concern about investment treaty arbitration. And the idea behind the inspiration behind this talk is to look at the historical dimensions of those concerns and how different states have taken different measures to try and try to address them. Together with the withdrawal from ICSID, of course, there have been other related developments. Some countries have taken the step to terminate their bilateral investment treaties, and not only in the developed world, but also in Europe. We've seen this, I think, specifically in the case of Norway. One very prominent multilateral investment treaty, the famous G3 free trade agreement, is no longer a multilateral treaty because Venezuela withdrew quite early on from that. We've seen movement under the Energy Charter Treaty, where a prominent member has also withdrawn his participation. And we've seen now developments in investment treaties where investor state arbitration is no longer a given. See the free trade agreement between Australia and New Zealand. Now, Lauren has very helpfully also remarked that there are interesting developments in Australia's recent case where it is being sued under a bilateral investment treaty, which I don't purport to comment on, but it is another example where a member of the OECD is being challenged in its regulatory decisions, in that case one having to do with public health, under the guise of an investment treaty. Now that's the general sort of tour of horizon, of course, and there are specific examples of how countries have tried to handle investment claims based on specific instruments and specific arrangements. One example of that is Argentina. Argentina is, so to speak, the best customer of ICSID. It has more than 30 cases, or has had more than 30 cases pending before ICSID on the basis of its investment treaty, let's say, practice. What has Argentina done in its cases? It's given us the benefit of a certain consistency. Without exception, it has put forward preliminary objections. Some of you may be more familiar with those than others, or even more than I am. But those objections have typically included the fact that investors have had prior specific arrangements, namely contractual arrangements, in Argentina with either the central government or a manifestation of the government. And those contractual arrangements have included specific provisions on settlement of disputes. So Argentina has said, first of all, well, this dispute shouldn't really be going to international arbitration. It should be going to local arbitration, but most likely local courts, local administrative courts, because that's what the investors stipulated in its contract. Excuse me. And sure enough, that's what happened in the first ever investment treaty arbitration against Argentina, in modern times at least, which was instituted by a subsidiary of what's now called Vivendi Universal. And that case has led to interesting developments, which we will see in a moment. but it's not just Argentina. July 2001, the North American governments thought it convenient to get together and stipulate a certain understanding, a certain agreement, a certain interpretation of certain international standards of treatment, in particular the duty of fair and equitable treatment set forth in Article 1105 of the North American Free Trade Agreement. North American Free Trade Agreement, I hardly need to say, is one of probably the first multilateral investment treaty or treaty that contains an investment treatment regime which binds more than one OECD country, and those mainly are the United States and Canada. And it, upon its conclusion, Mexico also became a member of the OECD. So it is a notable example of an intra-OECD member investment treaty. But then the states involved, the countries involved, felt compelled to make certain precisions and certain interpretations about what their commitments meant. So it's also, I presume, widely known that that interpretation noted that the duty of fair and equitable treatment under NAFTA did not involve treatment or did not require treatment that went beyond that required by customary international law. They left it at that, but it was an important interpretation given the then duties of the subsequent investment tribunals in deciding like cases. Subsequent to that interpretation, the United States itself developed a new model, bilateral investment treaty, which was full of these interpretations. Certainly it adopted the common interpretation that it has with Canada and Mexico. But it also had certain precisions about, well, what's the exact scope of the Most Favored Nation Clause? Does it extend to procedural arrangements in other treaties? The United States was very clear that it did not. What is the exact meaning of expropriation, and what types of expropriation are there, and how do we know when there is indirect expropriation? And the United States model sets out a bit of a list, a laundry list, not a checklist, but certainly a guide to let us know when we are when we can determine whether there's an indirect expropriation, and at the end a caveat saying that normally. General legislation of a non-discriminatory kind will normally not entail indirect expropriation. So countries have felt the need to specify, to make more, slightly more specific at least, their duties under bilateral investment treaties, which are normally very generally worded. What has that got to do with Argentina? Well, it has much to do with Argentina and other countries in the region, because the idea behind, first of all, the idea behind specifying the investment treaty obligations is certainly not new, and it has a long, long history. And secondly, many countries like Argentina are finding themselves in agreement with these interpretations that the United States has put forward in its model BIT, and I think there's at least one instance in which one country in that region has approached the United States formally to have a binding interpretation of its bilateral investment treaty with the United States. So these are developments which I think are of interest. And the whole inspiration of my comments are to try and determine whether our understanding of the international law of foreign investment as it exists today can allow states to take initiatives to achieve certain, let's say, greater predictability, greater convenience for themselves and for the investors that they attract to their territories, and at the same time preserve the object and purpose, the whole raison d'être of their investment treaty regimes, which is to promote investment, promote private investment for the purpose of economic cooperation. So the subtitle that I had suggested for this presentation was implementation. Implementation being the idea being that the whole purpose of defining and specifying these investment treaty obligations would serve to make them more certain, and also preclusion. Preclusion because when one specifies, when one chooses a particular channel, when chooses a particular meaning, one excludes also other meanings, the more adventurous meanings of fair and equitable treatment, perhaps, of expropriation, of most favored nation clauses, of investment, and so forth. And by that I don't mean to label any particular claim as adventurous or not. Sometimes there are quite legitimate business concerns for these claims, but the fact is that some claims have been perceived as adventurous. Well, what are the historical developments that that I've alluded to? They are, from my own personal background, the famous Calvo Doctrine and the Calvo Clause. Hardly much needs to be said about these doctrines. They appear in most textbooks, but usually up until 1990-92, at least when I started my PhD, there were footnotes. There were footnotes in the chapter of the International Law of State Responsibility saying, well, once upon a time, there were these countries that believed that foreign investors should be entitled to no more than national treatment. And they even had this delusion that by stipulating certain clauses in their in contracts with foreign investors, they could make foreign investors waive their right to diplomatic protection under the misguided perception that they were somehow waiving the right of their state of nationality, which remains sovereign, to protect its own nationals worldwide. Of course, these clauses had no effect. To the more informed practitioner and scholar of these developments, one will know that they did have some effect, and they did have some effect in certain specific circumstances. Those of you, I imagine most of you are now reading these investment treaty decisions and will have seen in the ones that I've mentioned in my in the summary of this presentation, allusions to the Calvo Clause and to the decisions that have actually given those clauses effect. The Calvo Clause, so-called Calvo Clause, was applied by a number of mixed claims commissions in the Americas, ranging from approximately 1865 to 1930 or 31 or so forth. The application of this provision was not always consistent. There wasn't an easily discernible pattern of decisions. This mainly because the underlying instruments which created the mixed claims commissions had different mandates. Some called for the commissions to apply absolute equity. Others provided for decisions on the basis of international law. Others already admitted liability, as was the case of the Venezuela-Italy protocol setting up that mixed claims commission. But most of them had to deal at some point or another with claims based on contract, so that the global settlement of that these mixed claims commissions were asked to bring about included contractual claims and not only purely international law claims. Perhaps at the time it wasn't absolutely clear at what point a breach of contract with a foreign investor also entailed a breach of international law. In fact, maybe it's not so clear today, but at least we have more guidance today that a mere breach of contract is not by itself a breach of international law. So these claims commissions had to deal with very general wording and were faced with the claims that had were based in all or in part on underlying agreements, concession contracts, normally things like railways or port concessions and so forth. There is incredibly a pattern, and I'm greatly aided in explaining that pattern by Professor Crawford, who in his Freshfields lecture of 2007 explained that at most the notion of jurisprudence constante or of a constant doctrine in investment treaty arbitration might be an evasive, an elusive achievement. One has to look at the pattern of decisions more than the actual sort of repetition of reasons. But in that line of mixed claims commission's decision, there is a pattern. One of them is quite remarkable, which is the distinction between government-owned claims and private-owned claims. At one point in this evolution, there was a specific pronouncement, and it comes not in the Americas, but in the US-German Mixed Claims Commission of 1923, that certain commissions or certain bodies are called upon to decide privately owned claims. And all those claims are channeled through these decision-making bodies by their respective governments, in that sense they are espoused. They are not the same as government-owned claims in the famous ICJ or permanent court pronouncement. They are not rights that the state asserts for itself through diplomatic protection. They are a sort of a mix of public and private nature. They are claims that are owned by the private claimant itself, but the government of the private claimant acts as its agent. And on that distinction, the U.S.-Mexico Claims Commission, which was chaired by the same umpire that decided this, that pronounced the administrative decision number 5 in the U.S.-German Claims Commission, came to the clear conclusion that the arrangements that the private individuals had with their host governments should be respected. And if the claims were made on contract, then the terms of the contract remain binding on the private claimant, and the commission had to respect them. The commissions could not change the contract that the private entities had entered into with their host governments. What was the effect of this? The long and the short is that the dispute settlement provisions of those contracts needed to be respected. And if they were not respected, then that served as a bar to the admissibility of the claim before the Mixed Claims Commission. Was that an absolute bar? Was it a dismissal of the case with prejudice? No, it was not. It was a dismissal of the case without prejudice, and only insofar as the agreed remedy had not been complied with. In a very general sort of summary sense, it was the reintroduction of the local remedies rule, where that rule had been dispensed with by the convention setting up the Mixed Claims Commission. So a rather specific effect to the so-called Calvo Clause, but one which was repeated in at least two cases in the U.S.-Mexico Claims Commission, and I think a further two cases in the U.S.-British Claims Commission, with different manifestations in other claims commissions. Some of the corollaries of recognizing the effect of this clause were that if the government repudiated the contract and abolished the dispute settlement mechanism, then there was no further obligation on the part of the investor. The right to espouse the claim could proceed, and the Claims Commission could rule. The other corollary was that the clauses were limited to the contractual relationship. So any claim for a breach of international law that went beyond the contractual relationship, for example, situations where the investor was not protected from revolutionary forces, for example, common in those days, went beyond the scope of the contract and therefore beyond the scope of the commitment to exhaust local remedies. And the commission readily said that in those cases, they would assume full cognizance of the case. There may have been some discrepancies as to characterization of the case, perhaps, whether it did or not extend beyond the realm of the contract. But the pattern is there. What is also, I think, quite clear in this pattern is that these cases were all cases of non-admissibility, that none of the cases were dismissed on the merits. Now, for those of you who, of course, follow this, you'll recognize that these are these same cases have been revived in modern investment treaty arbitration. And let's go back to the example of Vivendi versus Argentina. What happened in Vivendi versus Argentina? Well, a large European utilities company makes a very ambitious investment in western Argentina in a relatively poor district in a water and sewer concession and gets the concession from the provincial government, recognizing that this utilities investment requires a lot of monetary investment, a lot of work. It is in a bad way, and says, "Well, I will, apply all my my know-how to make this work. But there are misunderstandings. You can attribute fault one way or another as to the source of those misunderstandings, but they were very real. The company said that it found the facilities far, far worse than it had been led to believe. The local authorities said that the company was not sincere in its investment, etc. You can see the sort of outline of the dispute. And that quickly led to a claim for breach of the bilateral investment treaty between France and Argentina. One of the first of its kind. Argentina immediately says, well, there's an exclusive jurisdiction clause. The company has pledged its word, and it must go to the local administrative courts. The first arbitration tribunal, and I have to introduce a further caveat, I was the secretary of that tribunal and the secretary of the Vivendi Annulment Committee, and at no point did I have any substantive input into those decisions, I have to stress. That's not the role of the secretary, just it bears saying. The first tribunal said, well, we can take jurisdiction because all the jurisdictional requirements of the treaty are fulfilled, but because this claim is related to the contract, we're not going to decide whether or not there's been a breach of the contract because of the exclusive jurisdiction clause. The wording of the award was not as full as it could have been. The annulment committee decided that, in fact, there was no decision on liability, and for that reason, the tribunal, the first award, should be annulled. But the annulment committee spelled out very, very clearly the distinction between treaty claims and contract claims. And it resuscitated the Woodruff case, one of the Cabo Clause decisions, which held when the fundamental basis of a claim is based on a contract, then the investor must be held to the contract. But on the contrary, if the fundamental basis of the claim is a breach of an international obligation, then there's no need to be held to the terms of the contract, because the basis of the claim is different. It exceeds the bounds of the contract and may proceed independently of the contract. And on that basis, the Vivendi Annulment Committee held that the first tribunal, the underlying tribunal, should have ruled on whether or not Argentina was liable under the France-Argentina investment treaty. So that is one, basically the starting point of the distinction between investment claims, investment treaty claims, and on the other hand, investment contract claims. The distinction has been used consistently to overcome Argentina's objection, repeated occasionally elsewhere by other countries, that there's been a specific undertaking to go to local courts. It had a sort of second phase, a sort of corollary, if you like, in the case between SGS, Societe Generale de Surveillance, and the Philippines. Time is not abundant, so I will assume knowledge. SGS v. Philippines was the second case SGS had brought. Like the first case, it was based on the contract that SGS had with the local government for its investment in the Philippines. But in the case of the Philippines, it was based solely on non-performance, non-payment of the monies due under the contract. The investment treaty in question had a so-called umbrella clause. That is, the government of the Philippines vis-a-vis Swiss investors undertook to observe all of its undertakings specifically entered into with regard to those investments. SGS claimed that the Philippines was not observing those undertakings. Well, the contracts in question had also a provision for submitting all disputes under those contracts to the courts in the Philippines, and SGS had actually commenced proceedings under that clause before the Philippines courts. The first question for the tribunal is, did it have jurisdiction? It held that it did, because on the face of the treaty, it could decide whether or not the Philippines had or not observed its undertakings towards this investor. And then it recalled, well, what is the fundamental basis of the claim? Look at Woodruff. The fundamental basis of the claim is the contract. And so if we're going to follow Woodruff, then we should require the investor to observe the contract that it is claiming on. It may not approbate and reprobate on the contract at the same time, a well-known doctrine in many domestic systems of law. That includes the dispute settlement provision, which means that in order to claim on this contract, SGS must abide by its obligation to go to Philippine courts to determine whether it has been breached and how much is owed. And only then can this tribunal determine whether or not that contract has been observed or not. And it clearly said this is an issue of admissibility. We accept jurisdiction. We will retain jurisdiction. We will suspend the proceeding. And the parties must go away and determine the dispute before Philippine courts. SGS did that, not very happily, but it did that. And it came back with a document saying, well, this is a document that comes from the Ministry of Finance. And this is how much is owed. There was no ruling from the court, but the tribunal thought this was sufficient to proceed with its exercising its jurisdiction. In the end, I believe the case settled. I don't think there is a final award on the merits. But it's a very interesting decision because it seems to narrow the scope of the umbrella clause quite a considerable degree if there has been a contractual commitment to go to another forum. The tribunal interpreted its ability to rule on the umbrella clause exclusively on the question of observation of the contract. But if the parties had agreed to go to a local court to determine what the scope of the contract is and how much is owed, the investor and the state must abide by that obligation. Be that as it may, That seems to be the received wisdom, particularly that also the umbrella clause does not elevate the contract into one instrument governed by international law. I note that there are different views on whether that is the right decision, and also I note that in this sort of general pattern of decisions, it may be that the investor's recourse to local courts may have been more important than the actual contractual stipulation. For deciding that case. So I think there may be still some room to analyze whether a contractual stipulation without actual recourse may still be an obstacle to admissibility. What has happened after these two very interesting cases? I'd just like to point to two or three decisions, and then maybe we can open things up for discussion. In time, The first of these decisions is actually a state-to-state dispute. The Italian Republic versus Cuba. Italy sued Cuba under the bilateral investment treaty between those countries for alleged violations of the treaty with respect to Italian investors in Cuba. The award is in French, and I must excuse myself because my French is not very good. But the remarkable thing about that award and its preliminary award is that the tribunal recognized that Italy had the right to determine whether the treaty was being observed or not. Fine. So Italy had a separate right to determine issues of law, at least, from its investors. But secondly, Italy was also claiming, on the basis of diplomatic protection of these various Italian investors. And the tribunal said, that's fine, except that your right of diplomatic protection disappears if the investor chooses investor-state arbitration. And that is remarkable because basically this ICC tribunal, ad hoc tribunal, determined that diplomatic protection was a subsidiary means of enforcing the rights under the treaty vis-a-vis the investor. The primary means belong to the investor. And if the investor used the investor state arbitration mechanism, that should be preferred. As you will know, ICSID has a specific clause. As you will also know, Cuba is not a member of ICSID and never will be, I think, in foreseeable future. But the tribunal had no difficulty in saying this applies by analogy to any investor state arbitration. No analysis, and personally I think that a lot of analysis could be done about but I think about that decision, but I think it's a sound decision. The second thing it said is that the treaty does not dispense with the rule of local remedies. So if Italy, you are going to claim for these investors, and they have not gone to arbitration as they didn't in this case, they must exhaust local remedies because the rule is not deemed waived by virtue of the treaty. See Interhandel, and although they didn't cite it, they could have cited the case of Elettonica Sicula between Italy and the US, where the same principle was applied. So the right of diplomatic protection is still conditioned upon exhaustion of local remedies. I think very interesting for the pattern of cases we're discussing. But then we have a couple of recent cases. One is the case of Pantechniki versus Albania. Why is that an interesting case? Well, it applies for the first time, it gives effect to this, to what's called a fork in the road provision of an investment treaty. Fork in the road, as you may know, requires an investor to choose. Will I go to international arbitration or will I go to local courts? The distinction between treaty claims and contract claims makes that choice a little bit, let's say, rarefied. It's not clear if one is going to claim, one is able to claim on the treaty independently of a contract, whether this fork in the road actually has any significant effect, because I can go to local court for my contract claim and go to international arbitration for my treaty claim. It's never been really clear where the distinction lied. Pantechniki gave it effect, and Pantechniki, decided by a sole arbitrator, the award said, if the normative basis on which your claim is based is your contract, then you cannot bring a treaty claim simply by calling it a treaty claim. I, tribunal, have the ability to characterize the claim even if you label it a treaty claim. If the basis of your request in your claim is a breach or a payment or an obligation due under the contract, then it remains so, and because you took it to a local court, then you have taken the fork in the road. A slightly more robust application of a doctrine of preclusion than would normally be the sort of typical vis pendens analysis. Do you have the same cause of action? Do you have the same parties? And do you have the same object? Because the cause of action was nominally different, but it was not deemed to be substantively. And finally, a very interesting case involving Granada, back to the Americas. RSM production versus Granada. And this was actually two cases. Very interesting. The claims are typically based on misrepresentations by a government official, failure to perform a promise of some kind, and then allegations that the officials acted improperly. And so the serial litigation is justified by, well, bringing to account public officials. All very well. The issues at hand, RSM sued Grenada under a contract that had an exit clause. The contract was one for exploration and production of oil, which entitled RSM to a license by Grenada within a certain time period. Various things happened. The claimant did not observe the time period. By the time it requested the license, the time period had lapsed. Grenada said, sorry, the time period has lapsed. You're no longer entitled to your license. This led to the arbitration of the contract. The tribunal held that Grenada had not breached the contract because the time period had lapsed. The investor tried to annul the award, did not succeed. It then brought a treaty claim under the U.S.-Grenada bilateral investment treaty. And it said, well, now I have a treaty claim. I no longer have a contract claim. I have a treaty claim. And in addition to the breach of contract, there's now a breach of fair and equitable treatment because there was improper dealing. I now know why the ministry didn't give me the license. There was money exchanged with somebody else. There's an expropriation. There's a breach of full and constant protection and security. It also went to ICSID. At that time, ICSID had introduced a rule allowing, or expressly allowing, tribunals to dismiss claims for manifest lack of merit. And that's what this tribunal did. And it said, you've brought a claim against Grenada for the same facts. Those facts were ruled on, finally, by an ICSID tribunal. Your claim has been decided, and your new claim, although it alleges nominally a different cause of action is the same claim. And to decide your claim, your new claim, this second tribunal would have to reopen all the issues that you have already litigated before and finally litigated before another ICSID tribunal. It applied the doctrine of collateral estoppel, which it also took from different domestic systems, in particular the U.S., a right, an issue, or an obligation put forward before a competent tribunal and finally decided cannot be litigated. That's all very well within the ICSID context. You have the same overarching convention, the ICSID convention, which has a rule on finality. But the tribunal added another obiter dictum, which said it doesn't matter whether this was an ICSID tribunal, it could have been any tribunal. If the issue is finally decided, then the doctrine of collateral estoppel applies. And I find that very interesting to compare that dictum, which is obiter, to the SGS finding. Because what would have happened in SGS if SGS had obtained a final decision from the Philippine courts with which it was not happy? And what could it have done? Would the ICSID tribunal have said, you're bound by the final decision of the Philippine courts because that's what you stipulated in your contract? Or would it have said, despite that finding, I am an international tribunal under an international treaty, and I am applying an international obligation which says that a state shall observe its undertakings, and I am not bound by the rulings of a local court? That is an interesting disjunction, which I am not sure which way the SGS, the Philippines tribunal, intended to be solved, because the ruling is not at all clear. Now, where does that take me? How does that sort of rambling, where does that rambling lead to? It leads to the following idea, and I acknowledge that this is a little bit disjointed. We're living in what might become a post-BIT, maybe even post-ICSID world, in which states, although they have terminated their BITs, recognize that there is some merit in giving investors international protections. Is it plausible, first of all, and secondly, is it practical for a state to take initiative to govern its relationship with a foreign investor entirely under the under the terms of a foreign investment contract, which incorporates international standards, but which particularizes both the substantive standards and the procedural dispute settlement rules? So, may a state, in its contractual relationship with an investor, do something similar to what the United States has done in, in its new model, to what the North American governments have done under NAFTA, that is, state understandings of particular rules? What is fair and equitable treatment? What are legitimate expectations? When are legitimate expectations, when do they deserve to be protected? When is there an expropriation? What is the scope of the most favored nation clause? Do you get a completely different type of dispute settlement under the most favored nation clause? What are the conditions for making the investment, and has it been made lawfully? Something that is quite often discussed. Are you a qualifying investor? Something that is often discussed preliminarily. Is this a qualifying investment? Stipulated in the contract. Therefore, there would be less scope for discussion. What is the venue? The BIT might say, well, ICSID or Institrol, or maybe something else, Stockholm Chamber, ICC. Let's select the venue. Let's select which venue the investor will use. The procedural rules. Let's select the place of arbitration, because that's hardly ever determined by an investment treaty. So maybe it doesn't need to be halfway around the world that requires government delegations or the investor to travel and a great expense. Maybe it can be in a different place that has a modern law of arbitration. Maybe we can select the language. Maybe we can select other rules that have an impact on the cost of arbitration. These are all quite practical decisions which may be a benefit to both parties. Now, is that possible in principle? If one looks at the state of investment arbitration, one would have to say yes, because specific waivers have been recognized in principle to be allowed, and therefore, if there's specific sufficiently specific, then they should it should be acknowledged as possible. Is it practical? Maybe that's a different question. It might depend on what the view of the home state is. It might depend on whether the investors were willing to play ball. But there could be an attractiveness to that. And it might be also a question of whether the treaty might trump the contract. But again, on the basis of the few decisions that there are, one could say that the investor would have the right, because it's the ultimate owner of its claim, to fashion a remedy that, as long as it's consistent with the treaty, with the purpose of the treaty, should be enforceable. Those are my thoughts for today. I know it's closer to 2 than I expected. And you're not limited to asking me questions on what I said, I suppose. I did say a lot of different things, so perhaps that will lead to some discussion. Thank you.